Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of meaning do buildings carry beyond their practical function? And in what ways do we use the places we design, construct, and inhabit to convey something about our own vision and values? We rely on buildings to shelter us from the elements and warehouse our material possessions, but if that were all we used them for, we would likely have a far more limited architectural landscape than we do in the 21st century. So what role does emotion play in the demands of clients and the designs of architects? Rowan Moore is an architect by training and architecture critic for The Observer in London. His new book is called Why We Build: Power and Desire in Architecture. Rowan, welcome to Think.
Well, good afternoon. Very nice to talk to you.
What makes architecture such a perfect medium for human expression, and why do we sometimes not think of it that way?
Well, architecture combines being supremely functional. It very obviously has to do a job of sheltering us and making civilized lives possible, with attracting very strong emotions. It's a big thing to build a building, and it's not usually something done in a completely indifferent way. It's people do it with passion, because they have certain feelings they want to represent or assuage through building things. So it's a very strong and forceful way of communicating. It's also a slightly clumsy way, because the ideas of the architects and the clients are not always understood or shared by the people who use them. So it's a kind of way of form of communication between people who usually don't know each other and maybe even live in different periods of history, but a very strong one.
And most architecture considered important is, as you quite rightly point out, sort of inextricably linked to wealth and power. And wealthy and powerful people, not surprisingly, want the buildings they pay for to act as expressions of what they value.
It's expensive to build a building, and the bigger the building, the more expensive it is. I think all architecture of any size involves some kind of relationship of power. So even if it's the position of a kitchen in a home, in maybe a sort of Victorian townhouse that you might have in European cities, the kitchen would be kind of in an annex out at the back, and that would have been where the servants would have cooked for the family who owned the house. Nowadays, you'll much more commonly find the kitchen right in the middle of things, because whoever is cooking is seen as equal to everyone else. So that simple fact of how a house is arranged says something about the relationship of power of the people within it, and of course, power can be benign or it can be malicious. So it's a question of how that plays out.
Please continue. I'm sorry.
But then, again and again, it's really a recurring theme of architectural history. You see very powerful people, megalomaniac people, wanting to use architecture to demonstrate their strength in the most forceful possible way, and to use it to oppress other people. I mean, to build a building, you obviously need to own land, you have to have money, you have to be able to command a workforce. And if you can get hundreds and thousands of people to move stone around and build a perfectly symmetrical, regular building over a large area, that sends out a very strong message.
There's an inherent tension there's a collaboration, but there's also a tension between architects and their clients. Can you talk about how that affects not only the design process, but ultimately whose sort of vision and whose emotion is represented in the finished work?
Yes, well, architects quite often have their own kind of power complexes or their own desire to control, it seems to go quite often with the sort of professional mentality, which you want up to a point. You want architects to care about what they're building and to really insist on doing it well, and you don't want them to compromise too much. But, of course, it can very easily go too far. And, again, there are very many examples of cases where the architect really took over projects and clients didn't really feel it was their building anymore. There's the Farnsworth House in Illinois by Mies van der Rohe, which he built for Edith Farnsworth as a holiday retreat. And she ended up feeling it wasn't her house at all and, in fact, suing him. And the house was never really lived in until many years later another rich person who admired this architecture bought it and did live in it.
And then there are other great buildings that have spent more time as sort of museums to the architects themselves than as occupied spaces.
Yes. Well, actually, what happens quite a lot in the 20th century is that individual houses, single-family houses, are commissioned by people who want a great, great house, but they also want a sort of work of art. They want that they're sort of excited by the idea of commissioning something that is, going to change the world of architecture. And so they hire very famous architects or very promising architects who then build extraordinary houses, and Frank Lloyd Wright did many of these in the States. Quite often they end up costing a lot more than they're supposed to and not working as well as they should. So probably Frank Lloyd Wright's most famous house is Falling Water outside Pittsburgh, this amazing house built over a waterfall, which is absolutely beautiful, but it was colossally over budget, and the clients for that project called it, rather than Falling Water, they called it Rising Mildew because it had such bad problems with damp. And that was then used for some years for the purpose for which it was designed as a sort of, again, as a kind of country house. But quite quickly, these houses tend to become museum pieces, and they cease being inhabited, and they kind of get rescued by preservation societies, and then they're kind of opened up to the public, and you can buy tickets and go on tours of them. So they spend much longer as kind of large three-dimensional works of art and as sort of memorials of the architect than they do as actual houses that people live in.
There's such an astonishing irony to that, you know, to the idea that you are holding something up as the pinnacle of the ideal sort of home, the ideal example of design, and yet for whatever reason it is not being used in the way it was, for the purposes it was designed.
Yes, indeed. And that actually happens again and again, that architects and their clients have very strong ideas of what their buildings are going to be and what they're going to do. And then the vicissitudes of time are such that they turn into something else completely, which I find a really fascinating feature of architecture, because it is a very fixed, seemingly permanent business. Buildings are expensive. They take a long time to build. Building contracts are all about sort of certainty, completion. The building will be finished on this date. It will fit within a boundary of these dimensions, etc. But in another way, architecture is unstable in that it can be changed in its use. It can be changed by people adding things and taking away and converting. But it can also be changed perceptually. So in one generation, a building might be seen as a sort of monument to somebody's power. It might be seen as as threatening in some ways, the next generation might love it as a landmark, and that just keeps on happening. So what that means for architects is that they have to do something. They can't sort of just abnegate their responsibility. They have to make decisions. They have to make a kind of good bet about what their building is going to be, but they can never be sure that they will actually be right. So for me, the really best buildings are strong and decisive, but they also leave open the possibility that something unexpected might happen to them.
You have a really interesting chapter here about the Notting Hill neighborhood in London. Yeah. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, in the middle of the 19th century, a vast area of West London was built. Tens of thousands of houses were built in a matter of about 20 years. They were built speculatively by developers who were just trying to make some money. There were lots of bankruptcies as a result, booms and crashes. These houses were really minimally designed. They didn't involve a lot of drawings. They used kind of standard plans and standard details. There was no great architectural genius presiding over them. And then they went through all sorts of ups and downs. Because of these crashes, some of them weren't actually inhabited for 20 years or so. A lot of them became slums. They were designed to be sort of prosperous, kind of upper middle class houses, but the market wasn't there for all of them. So they started renting out individual rooms to much poorer people. When you started getting a lot of immigration to London in the middle of the 20th century, it became a big area of immigration. It became a kind of artist quarter in the 60s, 70s. It was a sort of, there was a bit of a kind of hippie community there. And then finally, in the last 20 or 30 years, it has finally become the thing that it was supposed to be in the first place, which is very high-end, very expensive housing. And I mean, the Prime Minister lives there, but he can't actually afford one of the better houses in the area. He's got one of the more modest ones. And that really shows how you really can't predict what's going to happen to your buildings. And the other question is, what is it about these buildings that enabled them to live all these lives but somehow keep some sort of consistency? And the answer is, the way they were designed, they have a front and a back, and the front is kind of classical and formal and symmetrical, and the back is much looser. It's made of brick, whereas the front was made with kind of painted stucco and meant to look like stone. And what this meant was that people could really change the back of these houses and the inside of these houses very easily, very directly. They could respond to all these different changes that are happening, whereas the front could still keep up an idea of kind of respectability, and it could still gave it a sense of order.
I have to jump in here so we can take a quick break. Excuse me just a minute. My guest is Rowan Moore, author of Why We Build, Power and Desire in Architecture. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with architect and architecture critic Rowan Moore. He writes for The Observer in London, and he's the author of the new book, Why We Build, Power and Desire in Architecture. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. And before the break, Rowan, you were telling us that these sort of row houses in Notting Hill have worked over the centuries because they had some flexibility built into them.
Well, yeah, it's a combination of the flexibility, but also because they made some kind of statement about what a street should be like, what a piece of city should be like. So they combined, there's an element of them that is about sort of order and a kind of idea of classical respectability, if you like. And there's a bit of them that is about letting you do what you want. And it's really these two things combined. It's a very simple formula, but it's a very effective one.
I was also fascinated by the chapter about Dubai and the Palm and the sort of the idea that this place was built with the idea that it would draw people, and yet it never really has worked in the way that it was meant to, despite huge, vast, unprecedented amounts of money thrown at development there.
Well, to some extent, it did work the way it was intended. I mean, Dubai is really used. Construction and architecture as a kind of sort of mythology, as a kind of something that is PR, but beyond PR. They made stories, fables out of the incredible things they were building. So, and they used modern media to kind of flash this stuff around the world. So probably most people have heard of the Palm Islands in Dubai. But not many people could actually say how many of them are actually there, because and not many people, before any of them were there, I think a lot of people probably thought they were already built, because they would have seen these extremely convincing computer-generated images of it. So in Dubai, they used construction as a way of sort of telling stories about a place that previously no one beyond the immediate region really had much idea of what it was about and what it was like. And they also used buildings simply as a kind of investment vehicle, as part of a speculative boom. And buildings are great at that, not only because it's possible to sink a great deal of money into a building, but also because buildings have this double character. They are instruments and they're symbols. So they do a job and they look as if they're doing a job. And sometimes they can look as if they're doing something and they're actually not. So you can build an apartment block and it might be full of people and they might be living there. It might be doing a job as a multiple residence. Or it might be completely empty, and you wouldn't necessarily know first off just looking from the outside. So Dubai had a very dramatic boom and then a very dramatic bust, and now they're kind of picking themselves up again. But architecture and construction played a very big part in fueling that for these reasons.
On the other end of the economic spectrum, at least, you know, there's been a crash now in the economy and things have changed. But there are the rebuilding efforts that have taken place in New Orleans following Hurricane Katrina. Talk a little bit about what we can take away from those projects.
Well, in relation to New Orleans, I talk about the projects that Brad Pitt sponsored and kind of made happen.
The Make It Right project.
I don't know how much your listeners, being considerably nearer to New Orleans than I am, will know about this, but he created an organization called Make It Right, and the intention was to rebuild homes in the lower ninth in the worst affected parts of New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. And he wanted to make really beautiful houses. He was shocked by what had happened and by the kind of degree of sort of negligence that had contributed and made things so much worse than they needed to be. So he wanted to prove that kind of professionals could do something better. And so he sponsored this project, which was about rebuilding homes in the lower ninth ward. And he rounded up a team of kind of architects that he thought were particularly interesting from the States and from other countries. And some of them have been built. And this comes in my chapter on hope, because there's a big connection between hope and architecture. It takes a degree of optimism quite often just to start a building project. You have to believe it's going to work. You have to believe it's going to make the world better than it was before you started. Architecture is obviously about the future, and you're designing something which, as I say, which you hope will make the world better rather than worse when it's finished. And it's also, building a building is a way of symbolizing hope. It's a way of showing to people that something is being done. And so something like Make It Right is not just about actually putting a roof over people's heads. It's about kind of symbolizing the idea of making the world better. And I think if Brad Pitt had really wanted to put as many roofs over as many people's heads as possible, he probably could have done it in a simpler way. But he did want to make a kind of show out of it as well.
As a sense of sort of restoring hope in the community and among members of the community who had been, who had lost so much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I couldn't quite hear that.
Oh, well, let's move on and talk a little bit about, because the next part of that chapter, you go into the World Trade Center and the discussions over what should happen there. What's interesting is that you actually start before there was a World Trade Center and give us a little bit of the history there, which is fascinating given the way we have come to feel about the down towers themselves.
Yeah, well, it's a long story. The Minoru Yamasaki, who was the architect of the Twin Towers, was a Japanese-American who came from Seattle originally. And he had experienced quite a lot of prejudice due to his ethnicity. And he was determined that the World Trade Center would be a place for kind of global understanding, a place where different peoples could come together and understand each other and kind of coexist peacefully, and it would contribute to a more peaceful world. And he designed these towers, which he saw as representing kind of abstract Japanese principles of beauty and harmony. But really, people didn't see them like that. And there was, when they were built, there was a great deal of hostility in New York because they were wiping out a district called Radio Row, which was full of little shops and businesses and lots of people were living their lives, and that was kind of annihilated to build this massive complex. And people in New York really hated the Twin Towers for a long time. And possibly a lot of New Yorkers were still hating them at 9/11. But then after they were destroyed, everyone, you know, decided they really loved them. So this is a sort of primary example of, firstly, how an architect's intentions and ambitions are not necessarily fulfilled, but secondly, how the meaning of a building can change hugely from one generation to another.
Yeah, so for anyone who was born sort of after the time that the towers existed, they didn't strike them as the law. It didn't remind them of the loss of an established neighborhood. They were simply part of the landscape.
Yeah, I think people who couldn't remember what New York was like before the Twin Towers were built, but while they were still there, they accepted them as part of the landscape. They became like the Empire State and the Chrysler Building and so on. They became part of the sort of kind of tourist skyline of Manhattan. So they went from being pretty universally hated to being kind of accepted while they were still there, to being actually kind of loved and missed once they disappeared.
So now we're left with the question of what to do with the space that remains. There have been many designs proposed, and you have to sort of you have to get to a hopeful place, and yet you also have to acknowledge what took place.
Yes, I mean there was a very long and involved debate after the towers were destroyed. Hundreds and thousands, literally, of ideas came forward. There was always a tension between the sort of wish to have commercial space on the site and the wish to commemorate what had happened there. And in fact, there was a very powerful force in all of this, which is that Larry Silverstone, who owned the lease on the towers, his lease stated, which was drawn up without any knowledge of what was going to happen, his lease stated that should, by some terrible accident, these towers be destroyed, exactly the same number of square feet of office space, etc., had to be reinstated, which is obviously a colossal amount of office space. So that actually lay behind the whole site through all the debates that were had about it. And that really determined to a great deal what is now happening there. But at the same time, people were having these very passionate debates about, well, how do you commemorate this event? I mean, personally, I think that the garden and the memorial they've created with these gigantic kind of waterfalls is a very appropriate memorial. I think there's a bit of confusion with, it was decided very early on that there should be a very tall building on the site as a kind of gesture of defiance, which I can understand. But what it has meant is that, and that's now quite largely built. But of course, that building, that symbol of defiance, is also meant to be a working office building. And the consequence is that they've ended up with the most expensive office building in the United States because obviously, the security has to be absolutely phenomenal, and they have to be absolutely certain that if anybody tried to attack it, that they wouldn't succeed, and that nobody's lives would be in danger. So, and it's also, they're not finding it terribly easy to find people who want to take space there.
It feels risky to people.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you or I would be completely comfortable about working there.
Yeah.
And it's kind of an example of what I mean about the sort of symbolic and the practical role of architecture, that this tower has been built as a symbol, but it has to perform a function, and the two elements in this case are somewhat conflicting with each other.
And there's also the reality, Rowan, and I wouldn't argue that there shouldn't be a memorial that has great impact to acknowledge the loss of life and the experiences that many people had related to the attacks on 9/11. But future generations won't feel as touched by those events as you and I do.
Yeah, I think, I agree with that. And I think they have one problem, which is with these gigantic waterfalls, they've got to keep them going forever and ever, which is quite a job. I think it's extremely important to memorialize events like this. But I think possibly in New York, on that site, they maybe been a bit excessive, or there was too much. I think the amount of kind of debate and in the end money that was put into it was a little bit too much, and I don't think it's really ultimately helped the kind of proper remembrance. In London, for example, there is no memorial really of the Blitz in the Second World War, mm-hmm. which killed many thousands of people, but there's actually no single memorial for that.
And have we gone too far into the place where when bad things happen, we instantly think about creating something, a physical space that acknowledges that?
Yes, I think it's a good thing to do, but it can become an obsession. Yeah, it can be a sort of, it becomes a kind of focus of people's feeling that something has to be done, that you have to kind of repair the wounds, and so to make a project of building something is one way of doing it. But I think sometimes you have to just stand back and say, well, are we doing this too much? Are we going too far?
My guest is Rowan Moore. He is architecture critic for The Observer in London and author of the new book, Why We Build, Power and Desire in Architecture. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with architect and architecture critic Rowan Moore. He writes for The Observer in London, and he's the author of the new book, Why We Build, Power and Desire in Architecture. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Rowan, we all want to feel happy. We all want to be prosperous in whatever physical spaces we inhabit. Is it asking too much to expect buildings to help deliver those things to us?
No, absolutely not. That's what you want buildings to do. And they can do it in pretty simple ways, like just giving you good light, good space, good environment. But I think it's possible to actually expect too much of buildings in some ways. I mean, in my book, I write about Dean Gardens, an amazing mansion in Atlanta.
Describe the place for us, because it almost defies belief.
Yeah, it's a kind of very extreme example of something like Xanadu in the film Citizen Kane. It was an enormous mansion where every room is in a different style. There's kind of Moroccan and Italian and Greek and God knows what. There's every sort of color and shape you can imagine. There's a great big landscape that went with it. And it was built by an entrepreneur called Larry Dean. And he said that he wanted to be like Dynasty, only happy, like the TV series Dynasty of the 1980s, which, of course, was not about happy people. But and unfortunately, his marriage didn't last very long after he moved in. And he hardly lived there at all himself. And then it stood empty for very many years. And that is a case of, I would say, of trying to get a building to represent all your dreams about your life and your family, to the extent that it kind of outruns the reality. I also talk about a British architect called John Soane, who built a very beautiful and famous house in London in the early 19th century, who had a very troubled family life. He had terrible battles with his sons, but you wouldn't know that from visiting his house. His house seems to be a kind of place for bringing up the perfect family and for instructing them in history and art. And so there is this tendency, common tendency, to try and get a building to represent what you might wish for in your life, but which isn't actually there. There was a British architect called Cedric Price who always used to tell a story about how he was asked to come and design a new kitchen and an extension, whatever, to the house of this couple. He spent an evening with them. He had dinner with them. And at the end of the evening, he said, you don't want an extension. You want a divorce.
Hmm.
And that's not uncommon, that people try and get buildings to fix things that are actually not really to do with architecture. On the other hand, you can't get a building to solve everything in your life. A building is the setting for life. It's the place in which things happen. Architecture is never really completed except by the things that happen in it. And so to say its background might make it sound like it's not important, but that's not really true. Because if you think about memorable events in your life, the background is part of that. It's very hard to think of something big that happens to you without thinking of where you were when it happened. And, of course, people care a great deal about what kind of place they're in when they get married or they have some event in their life. So architecture is extremely important in that way, but you have to really keep a hold on the fact that it is background. It can't do everything on its own. And I think a lot of mistakes that people make and also that architects make is they think kind of architecture and buildings can change the world unaided.
You write about a really remarkable architect who, I guess, is Italian by birth and moved to Brazil and really does seem to understand that architecture is this sort of frame that you describe for real life.
Yeah, she's the heroine of the book in a way. She kind of keeps popping up. She was called Lina Bobardi. She was born in Italy and emigrated to Brazil in 1946. And she died in 1992. And between those years, she built a series of buildings in Brazil, mostly in Sao Paulo, where she lived. And what I really like about her is that she got this balance that you want an architect to do something strong and memorable, an architect can't hide, an architect can't pretend that they're not doing something that's quite significant, quite a big part of people's lives. But she also had this ability to leave space open, to let the people who use the buildings finish the story. So, for example, she did, she created a kind of cultural social center. It was a place where people could go to dance or theater. They could also dance themselves. There's a library. People can play games. There's all sorts of activities that can happen there. And she was commissioned to build this building, and she turned up there, and the site was an old factory. And the idea was this factory was going to be demolished, and she was going to build a completely new building. But when she got there, she saw that people were making barbecues there, they were playing soccer, they were dancing, they were doing all these things. So she said, well, if the building's already doing the job, then let's just keep it. So she had to fight very hard to do that, and but she did do it. And then, but she made little subtle changes so that it was kind of a bit more beautiful and a bit more poetic. But she knew when to pull away as an architect. And then, as the second phase of this project, she did build a building, which are these kind of concrete towers that have got sports courts in them, and These kind of rise up above the city, and you've got these kind of corporate office towers above, around. But she made these towers that anybody could access, and she made the act of going from the locker room to the playing area, you go across these amazing flying bridges, so that usually when you're in a sports building like that, that kind of journey is in a corridor with fluorescent lights and a kind of plastic floor. She made that into a piece of urban drama. So what was great about her was she was capable of doing very powerful buildings like these towers, but she also knew when to just leave things alone and let people get on with stuff. And that's a pretty rare combination in architects.
Yeah, that humility is really interesting, because it wouldn't have been hard at all for her to present a design for the entire space there that was really involved. But she made some choices that were in service to the way the space was to be used.
Yeah. She also did things like she set up her office on the building site so that she could make decisions every day. Hmm. She could adapt the designs according to some new demand or some new sort of discovery. And she also remained involved after the building was finished, and she designed stage sets for performances. She designed exhibition settings when they had art exhibitions there. So she saw it not as creating an object that is finished on opening day, and then you just walk away from it and forget about it, which is what often happens. She saw it as something ongoing, that it was a continuous process, and the building was just one of these processes that really never had a beginning and never had an end. I'm going to talk about the role of time in architecture, and there is a tendency for architects to sort of like the fixed final object too much. There's something I call the Parthenon complex, which is the desire to create a monument for the ages that is not going to change. There's a close association between what's regarded as kind of high architecture, as the best kind of architecture, and tomb design. So sort of monumental architecture, as we understand it, kind of started with the pyramids and Egyptian temples, which are basically about death and eternity. And so it's kind of written into the DNA of architecture that it's about making things that just stay the same forever and ever. And while that has its value, I also, that tends to come at the expense of understanding the fact that buildings change and so on.
We actually have an email here from Steve who wants to know if you can speak to designing for a future 1,000 years from now.
Sorry, should we be designing for 1,000 years from now?
Yeah, or just the idea of it and what that would
encompass. Absolutely not. Because I really think you can have no idea what's going to happen in 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. You know, I think designing for the next 50 years is a reasonable time frame at most. I mean, there's a building built next to the Houses of Parliament in London for the use of the politicians, which they decided should last for 200 years. It's kind of an office building. It's where they have their administrative facilities. And the main effect of that was to kind of triple the budget. And I think that's a little mad because you don't really know. For something like an office building, you don't really know what the world is going to be like in 200 years.
I suppose it's a good way to get the client to pay more.
Yeah. It's a good excuse for doing something very high quality, which is, you know, that's nice. But whether it's the best use of that investment, I'm not so sure. I mean, you know, as I say, what you should do is you should try and design buildings that serve their purpose, but they're not so kind of rigidly customized to one single use that they can't change into something else. I mean, very many of the most successful buildings have had radical changes of use, like factories made into art galleries, etc.
Are we getting better at deliberately designing buildings that are resilient to change? I mean, it seems like, you know, factories were not built by people thinking, okay, maybe in 40 years this can be, you know, an exhibition hall or a concert venue.
No, they absolutely were not doing that. I don't think we are, actually. Well, there's many different things going on in the world of construction and architecture around the world, so it's difficult to generalize. But you're seeing a lot of very kind of bespoke office towers, for example, which are kind of highly air-conditioned, where it's pretty hard to imagine what else they could be except an office tower. And that's happening in the States, in the Middle East, in the Far East. But I might be wrong. People might find some incredible different way of using those buildings.
Rowan Moore is an architect by training and architecture critic for The Observer in London. His new book is called Why We Build, Power and Desire in Architecture. Rowan, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. We had help today on the phones from Christina Martinez. Lindsay Connect produced the show, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about Think and download the podcast at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.